From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Both gardeners and their plants have to be more resilient than ever these days in our changing climate, it seems. At the High Line in New York City, one of the best-known naturalistic gardens anywhere, that's especially so since it's built on the preposterous site of a former rail line 30 feet above street level, meaning a plant must be an exceptional performer to make the grade. Richard Hayden, the High Line's Senior Director of Horticulture, is here to tell us about the plants that excel in different extremes of moisture, for instance, or in shade, or offer the most ecologically, and also about how the team is using certain species to create weed-suppressing living green mulch, and also shifting their thinking about gardens as ecological communities rather than a collection of plants. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Richard Hayden joined the High Line 4 years ago to lead the team that manages the mile-and-a-half-long stretch of gardens with new areas set to open this year. On Saturday, May 30th, the High Line is holding its first-ever plant sale with 39 different species the team has propagated from the garden. Richard is here today to tell us about some of those top performers and the roles they play in making the High Line work aesthetically and ecologically. Welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm great. It's good to be with you again, Margaret.
Happy spring, or is it summer this week? I kind of have whiplash.
Oh, my gosh. We've got 4 days this week above 80 degrees in New York City. So we went from winter, 2 days of spring, and now we're into full-blown summer. So we're scrambling to get everything ready for the upcoming year.
Yeah. As I said in the introduction, I know you've told me that you and the High Line Horticulture team are thinking about gardens as ecological communities rather than a collection of plants. So can we talk about that just a little to get started? Yeah, because I think that's an interesting mindset. And how does that mindset shift affect you guys and the place, you know?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that when they were first designing the High Line and the gardens, Pete Adolf, our garden designer, worked with the design team, and they came up with this framework of using ecological habitats as a design framework. So we have woodlands, we have grasslands, we have woodland edge, and we have a wetland. And so by using those as a framework, obviously you can create this episodic journey that gives you a different emotional experience as you come out of the woodland into the grassland and seeing the wetland with the Hudson in the background. It's just a way to kind of tell the story, but it's also a really good way of building a garden that will support each other. All the plants have, you know, like cultural needs. And so it just makes, I think, for a much more evocative experience.
Mm. And so when you're looking at an area, I mean, or you have a new area that you're going to plant, I know you have a couple of new portions of the place, of the park opening this year. I mean, is that part of the thinking? Do you all talk about that? Do you know what I mean? Do you talk about the plant communities? Do you do homework on the plant communities?
Well, we do. And of course, we're not 100% native. Pete likes to say that gardens are for people. And so he wants to use the best combination of plants that he can put together that fit within that ecological habitat. So we have a couple of new gardens coming since you mentioned that. At 17th Street, we had a big construction project going on for 9 years, and those gardens kind of went fallow because we can't garden in those beds because there's buildings going on next door that could basically drop a window or something on you. So after 9 years, we finally had a chance to renovate that particular section, and I asked Pete to do a brand new design for us. And so that's kind of based on a grassland. He's using a new grass for us, which is Spirobolus aeroides, alkaline Sacaton. It's actually a West Coast species as a kind of matrix. So that'll be a new kind of grassland, and we're getting 15 brand new taxa, brand new plants for the highline in that design. And then up at 34th Street, where it's the very north end of the park, we're getting a new walkway in the western rail yard section, which, if people know, is the original kind of self-seeded landscape. It's not one of the design landscapes. But at the very north end where people come in, we kind of felt like it needed to be more special because people come to the High Line, they look on Google Maps or something, and they see entrance to the High Line, and they come in up at 34th Street, and frankly, it's just a little bleak. So Pete has done a brand new garden for us there. And because we want to block out the street and the bus stop and the parking lot, he's designed that as kind of a woodland edge, kind of thicket. So lots of shrubs, lots of flowering spring shrubs, lots of viburnums, red buds. A lot of, actually, there'll be a, I think it'll be a great bird garden because
I
there's
was
going to be,
just going to say, the
yeah.
birds miss the shrubs. The shrub layer is what we've really gotten rid of in so much of our world, and
Yeah.
that's so important for them, not just for, it's both for places to hide, places to nest, stuff to eat, pollinators then use it, and the birds go after the bugs that are going after the flowers. So the
Well,
shrubs are so important.
and lots of fall berries because
Yeah,
Pete is all
exactly.
about the seasonal look. So we'll have
Exactly.
lots of great looking fall berries, which will provide nutritious, many natives, by the way, which will
Yes.
provide, that nutritious seed for that migrating bird to really
Yes.
fatten up and be able to make it south.
Well, when you were talking a minute ago about the West Coast grass species that you said you were using it as a matrix. So let's just dip into that, because that's another word that I think people hear lately, matrix plantings. And it's sort of like, what is that? And obviously not in the, advanced landscape architect's description from the textbook, but like, to you, what's a matrix? What is that?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I think the way Pete Adolf uses the term, it's designing in drifts and designing in layers. So often, and it works both in woodlands and in grasslands, we'll have a couple of ground cover species that become what we call the matrix. And they're repeated and they are. They play well with others. They're not super competitive, but they just create what we like to call a green mulch. They cover the ground, they provide some interest, but they really provide kind of a stage for these other perennials to come up through and perform and do their thing and then maybe recede. The matrix works really well, for instance, with spring bulbs because, for instance, right now, let's say we've got some little species tulips and some little tender narcissus out in the garden. And as the matrix comes up, which in many cases can be things like autumn moorgrass, azalea, or it could be calamintha. There's a sterile species that we use. And as those come up, then the bulb foliage gets to wither down inside, and you're not aware of that withering bulbs. So it's just a way of kind of thinking about covering the ground. Mother Nature, we know, abhors a vacuum. So anytime that there's an opportunity for weed seed to get in, it will. So we like to cover it with plants that we like.
I think it was in a book with maybe with Noel Kingsbury. I think Pete and Noel, I think they made the analogy of that the matrix is the cake and the showier plants are the pieces of fruit and nuts that are mixed into the batter or something like that. Do you know what I
Oh,
mean? And
that makes sense. That's a
I
good way of
think I did.
putting
I
it.
don't think I made that up. I think that was from a book. They did, didn't they collaborate on a book?
They did. They've done
Yeah.
a
So
couple, I'm
I think
sure.
it was from that. It's fruitcake analogy. So there's
Yeah.
the batter, there's the main, the foundation, but there's also these yummy bits that show off here and there. And I remember years ago being told by Claudia West of Phyto Design. She said, Margaret, plants are the mulch. Plants are the mulch. And so that's that green mulch idea. And
Right.
it's besides being, as you were just explaining, that it hides some things and it conceals some things that are going out of bloom and so on and so forth. It also minimizes some maintenance if it's well executed, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it help
Yes.
weed suppression and other things?
Yeah, and it will actually help conserve moisture in some situations too. Says Cesularia, the autumn moorgrass, is a good example. It doesn't really seed around for us. It just creates this beautiful kind of, 8 to 12 to 15 inch tall, green, feathery understory. Blooms in the fall, kind of looks beautiful, has a beautiful kind of limey green. Because peat's very much about, leaf texture and leaf color, and flowers are just one small aspect of the way he designs. So when you've got these just great, bulwark plants that always are going to look good, it just gives a really nice opportunity for everything else to emerge up out of it.
So in the introduction, I was, speaking about how all of us, wherever we're gardening, it's getting a little crazier by the minute. And plants are being put to the test, and things that might have worked at a certain point, if you've been gardening a long time in a space, don't perform exactly the same way, and so forth. But you've identified some plants that are really working well for you, despite your extra challenging site, really very exposed site. And that's, some of those are going to be featured in your plant sale on May 30th.
Correct.
And with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, I can give all the links, how people can find out about that special day. And I know you're going to have some garden talks, some plant talks, and a Q&A booth or whatever, like a table with some of your expert gardeners are going to help answer people's questions, and lots of good stuff. But I think the categories you have are, like, there are habitat plants, the ones that really are super performers ecologically, and shade plants that put up with the low light conditions, and wetland and rain garden plants, and drought and climate resilient plants. And so you kind of have learned which ones work in those niches, so to speak.
Right. This idea of resilient plants really came out of this educational an exhibit that we've been doing called Nature in the City, which is also on the website. People can visit the website. You can put
Yeah, I'll get a link for
that
that,
link in the show
sure.
notes. It's just as it, the whole idea is that the Highland is so much more than just a pretty walk in the park. We are a really provider of ecological services here in the city, and so we are a habitat. We just did a bird walk, our first bird walk with the New York City Bird Alliance yesterday. We saw palm warblers, just a lot of new things coming in. So it's an exciting park, but we're also climate resilient, right? I like to say, if you want to know what you should be planting in the face of climate chaos, and we know we're getting longer droughts, we're getting stronger rainstorms, you look to the plants that are growing happily 30 feet in the air with less than 18 inches of soil. We get really these incredible wind tunnels that get formed by different buildings around us. We get reflected scorch off of glass high rises. At certain times of the year, you'll just see like a whole garden will just kind of brown out because the reflection from the sun is just hitting it just right. So, if you're a plant on the High Line, chances are, really able to resist a lot of these different aspects. And so that's where we came up with this idea of being able to actually propagate plants from the High Line. We've got over 2,000 plants that are going to be ready for sale on the 30th. And featuring the plants that we really felt, put the best face forward for the High Line, iconic High Line plants, that Pete uses frequently, but also the ones that are really able to withstand a lot of these different conditions.
Well, like in the habitat plant list, the anise hyssop, the columbine, Echinacea purpurea, the Monarda fistulosa, the various pycnanthemum, which is a super, pollinator. I mean, it's like that thing's a buzz, that little plant's a buzz.
And we've got three different pycnanthemum we're offering, actually, three different mountain mints. So we're really excited to be able to have to feature those. They're such great plants.
And you have, like, the Vernonias mentioned, and obviously the Asclepias. Again, it's not only met the test, it's met your test, because it's the extra layer of pressure, I guess. And yeah, you're welcoming, in a very difficult environment, you're welcoming this wildlife, all this activity. And you're seeing, as you just pointed out, warblers are visiting right now, and there's all kinds of interesting insects, and et cetera. So Yeah, and you've identified things that do in the shade for you, because you have a lot of trees. I mean, even though you only have like what 18 inches of soil depth or some crazy thing, the trees
Yeah.
are growing up there, and underneath
We
them are
do. We've
tiarella and various sedges and all kinds of great things.
Yeah, and we have our shade asters that do really well for us. One of our favorite shade ground covers is the Japanese forest grass, Hakone Kloa,
Yes.
which has such a great texture and has such great winter interest. The other thing, of course, that you have to be on the high line is you have to have, some sort of seasonal interest. And the Japanese forest grass, turns this beautiful kind of tawny caramel color. Stays up in these big drifts,
Yes.
moves. The other thing I think that's underrated in plants is the way they move in the wind. And that gives us that kind of fourth dimensional experience. And so that's a good one.
And that's one where, as you pointed out earlier, Pete, some of his plants are not native, and that's one that's not, but it's also not aggressive, invasive, whatever. I've had that plant sort of right by my leading up to the door, kind of along pieces of the path for decades, and it stays put. I mean, the clumps get a little bigger, but it's not like a crazy plant, and it's not a troublesome plant, and it's so beautiful. And as you point out, it has that almost four season really interest. So
And
it's
takes
yeah.
some deep shade,
It
takes
really
deep shade,
does. It really
yeah.
does. And I mean, I like I have a gold cultivar, and it, so it just screams, even in the shade, it's just so bright and so happy and beautiful. So yeah, so that's one of the exceptions to the largely native. There's a lot of natives in the palette as well. You
Yeah.
have another plant that I love that's not a native. Now I'm going to have to remember what it, oh, phloemus, right? It's like a mint relative, I guess, right?
Oh,
Phloemus roccellina,
yes.
a crazy little
Roccellina,
herby
yeah.
kind of thing.
Kind of a Mediterranean plant.
Yeah.
It's funny there, I came to horticulture from doing it in Los Angeles, and there were very few plants that I knew from my time in Los Angeles that actually translated to the Highline, but Phloemus roccelliana is one of them. Has this big leaf texture, and then has these flower stalks that grow up about 18 to 24 inches
Yeah.
above, with kind of a pale yellow, which one more time make a beautiful seed head and just really create, really good winter interest as well. The texture is so great with that plant.
Yes. Yeah. And again, I discovered it first many, many years ago in like an herb nursery or something. Do you know what I mean? It was this oddball, and I was fascinated by it. And yeah. So there are exceptions to the native thing. But yeah, so other kind of tough spots that there have been, like, are there kind of signature plants, do you feel like, that are developing for the High Line? Do you know what I mean? Like, when it's been now what, like 15, 17 years? Is that how many years it is? How many years?
17 since the first section opened, yes.
Yeah. So it's like, are there sort of, do you feel like there are plants that are synonymous with, because that kind of happens where you say, oh, I'm going to go to see the blah blahs at such and such garden. Do you know what I mean? Certain,
Absolutely. So
yeah.
I think one of the probably one of the most I feel one of the most iconic highline plants and Pete loves as well is Threadleaf Blue Star, Amsonia hubrechtii, which is
Oh,
a I think it's only
yes.
native to Arkansas and Oklahoma in floodplains. Anytime you hear floodplain, you think that's a tenacious plant because it can hold on,
It doesn't drown.
deluges of water, and then that spot may dry out later on. But it gets about what, 4 or 5 feet tall, ferny foliage, bright green, blue flowers in May or so, which are lovely. But then the real shine
The
happens in the
fall.
fall because it just turns this russet gold caramel, I don't know what color you call it,
All of
really
the
striking
above.
fall
All of the
color.
above,
Yeah.
Richard. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And with that texture, it's just such a showy fall addition. And it holds up pretty well for the winter too. The leaves will fall, but it still holds a nice kind of dome structure. So it's a great one. The rattlesnake master, another high, I think a great Highline, iconic plant, Eryngium yuccifolium. It's tall spikes, if you will. It's really unusual looking, and it's a prairie plant, North American prairie
Yes.
plant. And I think it got its name because the native people would break off one of the stalks and then shake it as they walk through the prairie to kind of keep the rattlesnakes from the pathway.
Oh.
But it has this really tall, kind of small globe-shaped flowers, which is their pollinator magnets. We see all sorts of fun pollinators all over them. And then one more time just has that beautiful winter structure because it holds up really well.
Is it kind of silvery? Yes, though. Is that,
Yeah, a little silvery gray foliage.
yeah,
Yuccifolium would mean
yes,
it's that
exactly.
foliage looking a little like a yucca, kind of
Yeah,
sword-shaped.
and that's on you. You know, I mean, for a plant of that stature, the silverish, grayish kind of thing, it feels a little unusual. So it's really a high drama plant, I think.
Yeah,
I think it's
that's a
beautiful.
nice way of putting it. I'm going to steal that high drama plant.
Okay, that's a drama queen. Yeah. So those are a couple. Anything else that sort of comes to mind for?
I have to put in a pitch for Euphorbia corallata, flowering spurge. It's one of our native euphorbias. It is the fine textured version of the rattlesnake master because they combine really well together.
Oh.
Kind of upright, very, very tiny white flowers in umbels, kind of round umbels. And it recedes for us a bit, but it's not too opportunistic, which gives you this nice kind of, dynamic feeling when it suddenly shows up over there and you think, oh, it looks good with that plant. But it's also a pollinator powerhouse and has, it has structure, has, a fine texture, but it also has structure at the same time and just really looks good with grasses.
So planting for, we have a few minutes left, and I just wanted to say that when we're planting for with ecology in mind, and creating plant communities and so forth, we're not doing onesies, right? Like we're not putting one of this and one of that. Is that another thing that you, because you've had such success attracting again creatures, you know, all these native creatures who wouldn't
Right.
necessarily be there otherwise. You do you use a lot of, as you said, drifts or masses and repeating things so that they can kind of find it, you know, that there's enough mass to attract them as
Absolutely.
yeah.
I think one of the reasons that we're so biodiverse, and even, Dr. Doug Tallamy has called us an important connector between wild places, with our so far 33 species of bees that are using the highline for food or shelter. It's the massing. We have 560 taxa, so different species and cultivars, and they are massed, right? He's got some great ways that he talks about the way, it's rhythm, it's sequence, it's texture, but it's repetition is the big one. And so when it repeats, just like in nature, you look to nature and you say, oh, there's 15 of that over there and then six here, and it kind of looks like it maybe got spread by a wind pattern or something. Feels natural, but it's giving you enough biomass that for instance, if you just had one milkweed, I don't think the monarchs would find it. But when you can put 15 or 20 in a certain section of the garden, then it becomes a critical mass. There's enough whatever the milkweed is giving off that the butterfly can find. Then you get that symbiosis, and so it just creates. And then the diversity of all of the plants, especially in the grasslands that we have, the diversity of flowering plants, the continual bloom of something going, basically from now until, October, November, just makes it even that much more an attractive habitat because we'll have something for everybody.
Right. And the other great thing about the massing or repeating, as you said, is that it helps the design aesthetically hang together too. So for people's enjoyment visually, do you know what I mean? It's like, as opposed to the
Yes.
onesies thing. So it's good for everybody, all creatures, great and small,
Absolutely. Yeah.
as they say.
Yeah.
So I'm always glad to talk to you. And I, like I said, with the transcript of the show, I want to give the information on the various things we spoke about, including the May 30th event. And just about visitation and so forth. When are the two new sections opening? When's the first one of those two opening?
So the 17th Street Garden is open now,
Oh,
and
okay.
we're waiting on plants to finish it up. Contract growing some plants, and they'll be ready in June. So that'll be finished in June. The
Okay.
34th Street Garden, it looks like it'll be opening in September or October.
Great. Well, more to look forward to. But thank you, Richard, for making time today. And I hope I'll see you soon and talk to you again soon too.
Absolutely. Always great to talk plants with you, Margaret.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and RobinHoodRadio.com.